Good. So I'm basically what I want to talk about is about the Bodhisattva Tara, but I also want to talk about the death of my teacher, Sangharakshita, who died on the 30th of October, and who's had a special connection with Green Tara, and it was a very, very special occasion. So Sangharakshita Bhante, as we call him, he'd been the teacher to many of us for a long time, and my life had been tied up with him since I was, for 40 years. And I sort of thought he was indestructible. I thought, he was 93, and he'd get ill, and I just thought he'd keep on recovering from his illness and come back. And I was actually on holiday with my girlfriend, and we were on La Gomera, which is one of the Canary Isles. We'd been out for a walk for the day, and during the day when we were out for a walk, we just kept seeing rainbows everywhere. There's a rainforest on the top of La Gomera. It's one of the most deserted of the Canary Isles. And everywhere there were rainbows, and sometimes it was as if the rainbows were just lying on the trees on the top of the forest. And we got back to the flat where we were staying, and Subhadramati, my girlfriend, she had a message from a friend of hers, Nana Marcha, and she went to phone him back, and she said I've got some bad news. And I said, oh, has somebody died? And she said yes, and she said it's Bhante. He's died, and I couldn't believe it. You know, it was like a world without Bhante was another world. He'd so much shaped my whole life, you know, and so much of my spiritual practice, and many others had come from him. And immediately, I just thought, okay, well, that means it's down to us now. You know, Bhante's gone, and it's down to other order members to take his teachings forward. And I also knew that I wanted to be with a large number of order members, and I wanted to see his body. And fortunately, the holiday was near an end, and his body was at Adisthana, and that weekend there was going to be an order weekend, which is like a large gathering of order members. And so I came on that weekend, and it was very interesting because I found up a friend of mine when I heard about his death, and who lives at Padmaloka, and I just wanted to get back to Padmaloka and be with my friends. And I thought that Bhante's death would be a bit of a crisis, and that I wanted to be back and do what I could do to support the people in the community there. And I phoned my friend up, and he said, "No, it's fine. Everyone's just carrying on, and you know, people are contemplative, but they're just carrying on with what they're doing." And he said, from what I can tell, it's the same all over the order. People are just carrying on with what they're doing. And everyone's quite calm. And I got to Adisthana, and it was like that. You know, Bhante had died. The community was functioning perfectly. There was this lovely, tranquil, positive atmosphere there. A number of us in this room were actually here at the time. And we had the order weekend. And after the order weekend, there was a gathering of senior order members, which I was a part of, and we had these vigils. So we'd meditate 24 hours. Not all of us would meditate for 24 hours, but there'd be somebody meditating for 24 hours in the week before his funeral. And also, his body was laid out in a small shrine room, and we could go and sit with him and sit with his body. And the thing was that his body hadn't been embalmed. It was just kept cool, and 15 people or so at a time could go and sit with him. And I've been around quite a lot of dead bodies, and all the other bodies I've been with, I felt an absence of consciousness. It's, you know, it's as if something has gone, and it's just a shell that's left. In this case, he was just incredibly present. And there was this very, very strong atmosphere around his body, and we were all sit. You know, a number of us would come in from different times and sit and meditate around his body, and this went on for the week up to the funeral. And then on the funeral itself, about 1,600 people turned up for the funeral, and in India, apparently, where a large number of Order members lived, there were 61,000 people watching it on, from a film that was being made at the time, watching it being streamed, and more than that, because there are also people watching it at home privately and so on. So there are all these people watching the funeral, and the funeral was incredibly moving. And at the end of the funeral, I was standing close to the grave. He was being buried in a cardboard coffin. I was standing close to the grave, and some of his closest friends were carrying the coffin and lowering it into the grave. And you could see they were very moved emotionally, and I felt very moved. And someone read a poem. And then one of the Order members who used to look out for him took a conch and blew a conch in each of the four directions, each of the four cardinal points. And and then the grave started to be filled in. And almost immediately after the grave had been filled in, people started circumambulating the grave, walking around the burial mound. And in the following days, we were there, and we'd come out of meditation, and quite spontaneously, we just find ourselves walking round and round Banti's burial mound. And you could tell that already it had become a place of pilgrimage. And that was what he'd wanted. He wanted a place where people could come to remember him after his death. And a friend of mine was saying afterwards that, in a sense, we hadn't lost anything, because he passed everything on. He'd passed on everything to us, to his order, this order that he'd set up. And that he said it was almost as if seeing this frail old man of 93 walking around or going around the grounds being assisted by holding onto somebody's arm was a distraction from who Banti really was. And Banti wasn't just this 93-year-old body. And after his death, it was as if something had been freed up. Something, I don't know, indescribable had been freed up. And somehow, now it was all in us. You know, some part of that was in us. It was a very strange experience. A very remarkable experience. And during the last year of his life, he saw 400 people individually. This 93-year-old man, he saw 400 people and had individual meetings with them. And what that means is, for each of those people, that would have been a significant meeting. It would be something that they'll remember all their lives. So it would have a significant effect. And towards the end, every time he met somebody, he had his some of his possessions, his Buddha rupas, his Buddha images, all lined up. And he'd give one of these Buddha images to the person that he'd been meeting, and gave it to them, and they took it away with them. And this is what a bodhisattva does at the end of their life. They give away their possessions. It's part of the preparation for death. And when Dado Rinpoche, Sangharakshita's own teacher, died, he sat up all night in meditation on the night that he died, and he even gave away his robes. So he gave away his robes and just sat there in civilian clothes. And Banti Sangharakshita had affected hundreds of thousands of people positively throughout his life. He wasn't just a normal person. He wasn't just a normal man. He was a great teacher. And I think we're much, much too close to him now to realise the significance of where he stands in the Buddhist tradition. And I think that will just come much, much later on. But it felt as if we were burying a great teacher, a great bodhisattva. And that's what I really want to talk about. I want to talk about the bodhisattva. And there are three different types of bodhisattva. So a bodhisattva is someone who dedicates all his energy, all his life, for the sake of enlightenment, but not just for his own sake, but for the sake of all beings. And the first sort of bodhisattva is an aspirant bodhisattva, and that's someone like the order members that you're seeing around this room. So the bodhicitta, the transcendental will to enlightenment, hasn't actually arisen in them, but they're aspiring towards that. They're aspiring to live their spiritual life, not just for their own sake, but for the sake of all. And that's the tradition that we're trying to follow. We're trying to follow that bodhisattva tradition in our order. And then there's a human being who, in whom the bodhicitta has arisen. And they're not motivated just by their own individual will. They're motivated by something called the bodhicitta, which is like a suprapersonal force that manifests through them. It's as if the transcendental has manifested through them and given expression to them, to their lives. And it's as if something is operating through them. And then the third type of bodhisattva is the archetypal bodhisattva, such as Tara, which is on the shrine, which are purely transcendental figures, which I'm going to be talking about tonight. And when Sangharakshita was quite early on in his spiritual life, and he was living in India, he was occupied with a problem. And the problem was, how do you overcome the ego when you're actually using your ego to practice the spiritual life? So how do you use the ego to get beyond the ego? And at first he thought he could just surrender his own will to the will of his teacher, who was Jagdish Kashyap. But the problem was that Jagdish Kashyap, his teacher, didn't ask him to do anything. So in the end, he came across Tibetan Buddhism, and he came across tantric initiation, an initiation into taking up a visualization and mantra recitation practice on a Buddha or a Bodhisattva. And that way, surrendering yourself to this transcendental figure and allowing that to operate through you for the good of all beings. So these different Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, they represent different aspects of enlightenment. So they might represent compassion, they might represent wisdom, they might represent transcendental purity. And you meditate on a particular Buddha or a Bodhisattva, and through meditating on them, you start to develop the qualities which the Buddha or the Bodhisattva embodies. And Tara embodies the quality of compassion. And when Sangharakshita was living in India, in the Himalayas, in Kalimpong, he decided to seek tantric initiation. And he came across a teacher called Chetral Rinpoche. And he went to see him. And Chetral Rinpoche, and he asked him, "What is my yidam? What is that figure? What's that aspect of enlightenment that I have a particular affinity with?" And Chetral Rinpoche told him that it was the green Tara, which is the figure on the shrine. And he took up meditation on the figure of green Tara. I think that the first thing you notice about green Tara is that she's green. She's very green, and that's quite unusual. It's quite unusual to think of a green figure. But she's also very beautiful. And green has all sorts of colour affects us greatly. And green is quite a restful colour. It's quite easy to relax in green. That's why it's so easy to relax in nature. I think that's one of the reasons why nature is so attractive to us. She's 16 years old, and she's dressed an Indian princess. So she wears a crown, and she wears silks and jewels and ornaments. And she's very beautiful. The thing is, though, Green Tara is not a woman. Just as Amitabha, the figure up there, is not a man. And neither are they non-binary either. They're none of those things. They're completely beyond sex or gender. They're actually an embodiment of compassion, taking manifesting in a female form. But they're quite beyond gender. They're quite beyond colour. They're quite beyond form. And when I was when I was having my own ordination course in Tuscany in 1984, I took up a practice called the Vajrasattva practice, which is a white Buddha form. And Sangharakshita was talking about visualization practice, and he said that at a certain point, you would drop the form that you've been given. So you meditate on this particular form, but after you've been doing that for a few years, you drop the actual form, and you just try to contact the quality that that form is embodying. So the form is just a gateway into experiencing compassion. Green Tara is a symbol. But through meditating on that, I don't know how it happens, but through meditating on Green Tara, one starts to become more compassionate. Those qualities start to affect you by contemplating that figure. In the same way, if you contemplate the figure of Manjigosha, who holds the sword, your mind becomes clearer. You become more wise. Green Tara is compared to a virgin, a mother, and a queen. So she's said to be like a virgin in the sense that she's metaphysically pure. So that her wisdom is always fresh, it's always new. And I know virginity probably hasn't got a very good press in the West because it's associated with the Virgin Mary and all the rest of it, and a lot of things people are trying to get away from in Christianity perhaps. But in Buddhism, chastity and virginity are symbols for wholeness and independence, which is quite interesting. I think that's probably worth reflecting on. She's a mother in the sense that she feels just as a mother would feel for her only child. She feels the same love for all beings, for everybody. So if you can imagine that, a mother's feeling for her only child, that's very, very strong. She'd give her life for her only child. But Green Tara feels that for all beings. And she's like a queen because she has dignity and sovereignty, and she's fearless. I took up the Green Tara practice myself about 3 years ago. I'd been doing the Vajrasattva practice for a number of years, and I felt there was something missing in my spiritual life. I felt I needed to bring in another quality. I felt I just needed to become a bit kinder and a bit softer. And a friend of mine took up the Green Tara practice, and I thought, okay, I'll take it up with him. And I didn't find I was naturally attracted to Green Tara to start with. I sometimes felt quite a lot of resistance to doing the practice, but I knew that I had to do it. There was some sort of spiritual intuition in me that knew I had to meditate on the figure of Green Tara. And the first thing you notice when you meditate on Green Tara, I think, is her mudra. So mudra is a gesture. It's a hand gesture. And Green Tara's mudra is like this. This hand, her right hand, is stretching out in generosity, the mudra of giving and spontaneous helpfulness. Her left hand is held like this, and it's fearlessness. So it's the mudra of fearlessness. So you could say that what Green Tara is giving, or what she's offering, reaching out to all beings with, is fearlessness and generosity or spontaneous helpfulness. And doing the practice, that mudra just became very strong, and I could just feel how potent that was, and just how that's really what people need. That's really what people need in the world today. They need confidence. They need fearlessness, because the world is a very confusing place and a very threatening place to grow up in. There's a loss of values. It's very unclear what to believe in. There's a lot of insecurity around. There's a lot of change going on. And people often don't have much confidence. People often don't have much confidence in themselves. So to be able to give fearlessness is a real gift. And also just spontaneously to be able to help people. That's very important. And that's what Green Tara is offering. And also, her legs are significant as well. So her right leg is stepping down into the world. And you can see on the figure that her right leg is stepping down onto a lotus. So she's reaching out to the world. She's stepping down into the world. At the same time, her left leg is up in meditation. And that's what you need to cultivate in spiritual life. You need to actually be deeply immersed in meditation, the tranquility of meditation, and the states of mind that come from meditation. But at the same time, if you just do that, it's just too self-referential. It's too precious. At the same time, you need to be reaching out down to others and helping others and offering them the Dharma, offering them the possibility of real change, the possibility of real happiness. So that's what Green Tara is doing. And it's through doing that practice that one starts to cultivate those qualities oneself. And in the practice, one offers... no, I won't take it that way, I'll take it another way. Green Tara is also known as a quick way to wisdom. And wisdom, from a Buddhist point of view, is not just intellectual penetration. Wisdom is also an opening of the heart. Wisdom is as much an emotion as an intellectual understanding. Now, after Bhante's death, I felt very connected with Green Tara practice. And when we were meditating in the shrine room at Adisthana, I'd find that if I did the Green Tara practice, I felt connected with Bhante, with Sangharakshita. And at the time of his death, he said that he wanted 5 mantras to be chanted during that time. And the mantras were Amitabha, who is the Buddha of love, Shakyamuni, who is the historical Buddha, Manjugosha, the Bodhisattva of wisdom, Padmasambhava, who embodies the archetype of the guru, and Green Tara. And we were reciting these mantras all the way through the week leading up to his death, up to his funeral. And when I used to think of Bhante, I used to think of him very much as being very wise, having a very clear mind, very much embodying Manjugosha. And he also embodied the teacher, the guru, the archetype of Padmasambhava. But in his last years, as an old man, more and more, he seemed to come back to Tara and seemed to embody Tara more and more. Very kind, very patient, very compassionate, very wise. Now, there's a question which arises, and that is, why don't we all meditate on Buddhas and Bodhisattvas? Why not introduce Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, you know, at any level, or at the beginning of to make them available to everybody, make those practices available to everybody? And I think the answer goes back to Sangharakshita receiving the Tara practice from Chatral Rinpoche. And before Chatral Rinpoche would give Sangrach to the Tara practice, he asked him a number of questions. And first of all, he asked him questions on the Vinaya, and then questions on the Abhidharma. And what the Vinaya and the Abhidharma represent are ethics, having a common system of ethics, and having a common system of practice. And he wouldn't introduce that until he was clear that Sangharaksha had the same basic understanding of the spiritual life that he had himself. In other words, there were preliminaries before he could introduce him to the practice. And I was thinking about this, and I was thinking, well, what does that represent in our particular movement? And I think what that represents is the whole training for ordination. You know, so we have different levels. We definitely have a path in Sri Ratna. People come along, they learn to meditate, they come to the centre, they're at the level of friends. Then they might decide that they want to take their involvement deeper. They become mitras. For many people, they might just want to stay at the level of friends, or they might want to stay at the level of mitras. That's quite all right, that's quite fine. There's no pressure in any sort of way to go further than the stage that one's actually ready for. And the Dharma is always, it's just an open invitation, you know, and you can come and go as often as you want, you can practice at whatever level you want, nobody's going to put any pressure to do more than you feel comfortable with. But some people, maybe it's a minority, feel after being involved for a number of years that they want to actually make a commitment to practicing in this particular way. They want to actually join the order, a fellowship of men and women who are committed to this particular approach to practice. And they may ask for ordination. And I think what those questions that Chatra Rinpoche was asking, for us, they're represented in the ordination training. And in the ordination training, you're making clear that you've got the same level of understanding. You're committing yourself to the same path, and the same set of teachings, the same ethical framework. And then at the time of ordination, one's given a new name, and one's also given a sadhana practice. One takes up a sadhana practice, a meditation on a particular Buddha or Bodhisattva. And in a way, that's one of the things that unites us as an order. We're all meditating on a Buddha or a Bodhisattva which represents that particular aspect, that particular affinity of enlightenment which we feel we have an affinity with. And when order members are meditating together, doing their sadhana practice, it's a way of unifying the order, because we're all moving with the same aspirations towards the same goal, but through different gateways. And the different bodhisattvas represent the different gateways. In a way, a bodhisattva is not a particular person. One person can't do very much to change the world. One person practicing on their own can't do very much as a force for good in the world. So a bodhisattva, in a way, is more than one person. A bodhisattva is a number of people, a body of people, who come together with the same strong aspirations and the same strong feelings and practice for the good of the world, not just for their own enlightenment, but for the enlightenment of all beings. And in a way, that's what the order represents. The order itself as a whole represents a bodhisattva. And together, as an order, with lots of different qualities, lots of different personalities, lots of different strengths, operating in different countries throughout the world, perhaps we all together add up to one bodhisattva. And that's what we're trying to do. And in the end, the bodhisattva is not personal, and it's not collective either. It's something that transcends both of those categories. So I think that's all I want to say. They're just a few thoughts that I've jotted down, and I wanted to just introduce this idea of the bodhisattva, and particularly talking about Tara. What I'd like to do, I'd like to invite you to ask any questions if you want to, and have a bit of a discussion about this and anything you, any aspects you want to open up. And,